Hello, this is Steve, and we are about to start our lecture on non-Darwinian forces. So right now we have gone through a bit of microbiology, a bit of what I've called population biology, and next we're going to cover natural selection, but before we do so, we're going to take a closer look at mutation, migration, and genetic drift, not necessarily in that order. So here we go. This handy-dandy frustrating sign here. Yes, so non-Darwinian forces is the topic of this lecture. We can also talk about mutational impact on phenotype. And we have basically three different types of mutations, beneficial, neutral, and detrimental. And I'll talk about these three, starting with beneficial. So a beneficial mutation simply means that an organism's fitness, its fit to its environment, increases over the parental allele, parental genotype. So you have an organism, it mutates, and suddenly it's able to do things better, such as survive and reproduce within its environment. And that mutation is called, therefore, a beneficial mutation. Beneficial mutations generally are of lower likelihood than either neutral or deleterious mutations. It's rare to come up with some random thing that works better than it is to come up with random things that either don't change things or make things worse. Recall that whenever you have benefits, they're going to be context dependent. Evolutionary biology works within a context of ecology. The specific environment that an organism lives in is going to dictate what alleles are beneficial and what alleles are not. So an allele possibly can be beneficial in one environment and even detrimental in another. One example of a beneficial mutation is a compensatory mutation. In a compensatory mutation, what you have is a compensation for some other mutation that has lowered fitness. So you get a mutation, it's lowered your fitness. It's possible to have another mutation that in fact raises your fitness back up again. Not necessarily all the way to where it was, but higher than would be the case with just a single mutation around. And that compensating mutation is called a compensatory mutation, and it's an example of a beneficial mutation. Now, compensatory mutations, like beneficial mutations generally, will be context dependent. It will be dependent perhaps on what environment all of this is happening in, but also the fitness benefit likely is dependent upon the presence within the population or within the individual of the original deleterious mutation. You take away the deleterious mutation and the compensatory mutation may not provide a benefit. In fact, it might even provide a detriment. So these compensatory mutations can be either found in the same gene or they can be found in different genes. If they're found in different genes, then the compensation is known as an epistatic interaction. This would be an interaction between two different loci that gives rise to some kind of phenotypic change. Having compensatory mutations can have the effect of reducing the cost of evolutionary accumulation of deleterious mutations. So if you have a mutation, it doesn't help, it hurts you. You can make up for that mutation, not necessarily by reverting that mutation back to the original allele, which can happen with very low occurrence and therefore is unlikely, but instead by having a mutation that occurs somewhere else in the same gene or a different gene that literally compensates for the fitness reducing effect of the original mutation. Again, not all the way necessarily, but raising the fitness of the individuals that carry the original deleterious allele at least a little bit. And also it's possible for multiple compensatory mutations to work together. So you have a deleterious mutation, the fitness is raised by a compensatory mutation, the fitness is raised again by a second compensatory mutation, the fitness is raised again by a third compensatory mutation, and so on. So then we can return to this. So we've talked about deleterious mutation. Well, actually, we've talked about beneficial mutations. We haven't quite gotten to these, have we? So if we talk about beneficial mutations, with a beneficial mutation, fitness is on the side of that mutation. So assuming it's more beneficial than other mutations within the population, or assuming that it's part of a genotype that is more fit than other genotypes within the population, then you can have deterministic increases in the frequency of the beneficial mutation, thus forming a polymorphism. And if it's a sufficiently beneficial mutation and there aren't other competing fitness alleles or competing genotypes, then you may very well have ultimately the fixation of that beneficial allele. If you have a mutation that in fact provides no fitness benefit, the natural selection isn't going to drive you towards polymorphism and fixation, just genetic drift. So it's a much weaker effect and for the fixation of a neutral mutation. And with deleterious mutations, not only is natural selection not helping out, but it's actively blocking the increase in the frequency of those alleles, and therefore the likelihood of a deleterious allele, except in very small populations, going to fixation is small. So back to compensatory mutations. So what we have here is a protein that, or a complex of proteins made up of two different kinds of proteins, this TSR and TAR proteins, and you can have mutations occurring in these in the genes that are responsible, that encode these proteins. And here these mutations are shown as stars. This TSR asterisk is indicating that you're seeing the mutated form of this protein. And this is showing this complex here, looking from the top, so from up here. And you can see there's one, two, three different complexes, and you've got change in the protein structure occurring where the stars are. So this is the TSR protein with this mutation. So the TAR protein in this case has no mutation, and the implication here is that you have poor interactions going on as a consequence, less effective interactions between the TAR and the TSR. As a consequence of this mutation that's in the TSR gene. But it's possible for there to be a compensatory mutation occurring in the gene that's responsible for the TAR protein. And they're showing that here with these triangles. So that's a compensatory mutation. They're showing it adjacent to the star. And as a consequence, the interaction between these two types of proteins can be improved again. Maybe not to the point where you see where it's what you see with wild type, but better than with just the one mutation alone. And this mutation that caused this change in the protein here is described as a compensatory mutation. Again, it's a kind of beneficial mutation. It's a kind of conditional beneficial mutation. It's dependent upon, at a minimum, the presence of this other mutation in the same genome. So TAR expressing the compensating mutation is what's shown here. So we can also talk about genetic complications while we're at it. So epistasis means that one genetic locus affects the phenotype associated with a different genetic locus. So where are we seeing that? Well, we've seen it specifically here. We have one genetic locus that's the TSR locus, another that's the TAR locus. A mutation in the TSR locus reduced fitness, but another mutation in the TAR locus raised fitness back up again, maybe not all the way, but back up again. So this is a phenotypic effect of this protein on this protein, or the gene associated with this gene on the consequence of the expression of the gene that's responsible for that protein. So you have this intergenic interactions going on, here explicitly shown within a protein complex that's the product of two different genes. And these interactions are known as epistasis, intergenetic interactions. So with epistasis, the fitness associated with an allele is dependent upon the genotype that the allele is found in. So compensatory mutations are not always compensatory. You need whatever the original detrimental allele is in order for the compensation to occur. We can also talk about phenotypic plasticity. This means that the phenotype associated with a given genotype or gene is a function of environment. So you can have one gene and multiple possible genetic or phenotypic consequences of the expression of that gene. this whole idea of there being an interplay between environment and phenotype and genotype is a complicated thing, and it's one of the things that makes biology both complex and quite interesting. Another concept is that of pleiotropy. In pleiotropy, you have one gene that impacts more than one phenotype. So you have multiple phenotypes being affected, for example, by a single mutation in a single gene. There's also a concept which we'll be talking about a lot called antagonistic pleiotropy. Here you again have a single mutation, but it's a mutation that has a positive impact on fitness in one environment, but a negative impact on fitness of the same organism, same genotype, in a different environment. So you have going up in one case and going down in another, where the different cases are different environments. So in one environment you have going up, the other environment you have going down in terms of fitness. And what this basically is an example of specialization. You have a mutation that increases your ability to do one thing in one environment, but it's at the cost of your ability to do another thing, perhaps the same thing in another environment. So an example of antagonistic pleiotropy is what you see when you have the attenuation of viruses during vaccine development. You grow the virus in one environment, one kind of animal or tissue culture, it gets better and better and better at growing that in that environment, but the consequence of that is you have a worsening of the fitness of the virus in what would be the original environment, such as growing inside of us. So you end up with a virus that in fact is less capable of replicating, but still is antigenically similar to the original virus, and thus it becomes a good live attenuated vaccine. So this is how you saw, or you were introduced to epistasis probably earlier in your biology career, in introductory biology. It's basically showing you've got this mouse, and the mouse has a bunch of different alleles and two different loci, and the effect of the C locus is to tell you whether or not you have color at all. It's a dominant recessive relationship between big C and little c, so when you have a little c individual, you have no color. And when you have at least one big C, you have color. So the color of these mice is dependent not just on the genes that are responsible for what color the mice would be, but also the genes that are responsible for whether or not the mouse is going to have any color at all. This is how we learned in intro genetics. And note that there is an interaction. This is the key generalization. There is an interaction going on here in terms of phenotype between the B locus and the C locus. The B locus, for it to display its associated phenotype, it is dependent upon what alleles are present in the C locus. So going back to here, just explicitly talking about compensatory mutations as epistasis. So you've got these gene product interactions. Those interactions can have a great deal of specificity. When you have a mutation that degrades those interactions, you can have a countering mutation that restores to a degree the interactions. These are epistatic interactions because, in fact, they're occurring between the products of two different genes. So you have mutations that, in fact, are affecting the expression of a protein that is found, that is encoded by a different gene. And this is showing phenotypic plasticity. So you have phenotype here on the y-axis, environment of changing of some sort on the x-axis. The default state is you have no change in phenotype as a function of environment, but it's possible for the phenotype to change in various ways as a function of environment. And these changes in phenotype as a function of environment is known as a plasticity of phenotype or phenotypic plasticity. And this is an example here. We put this cloth, perhaps as an ice pack, on the back of this hair, and what you have is a change in the color of the hair in response to literally of the hair. Literally, what you have here is the environment's being changed by the use of this ice pack, and that's the change that you see. Another way of describing phenotypic plasticity is in terms of what are known as reaction norms. And reaction norms basically are measures of how genotypes respond phenotypically to environments or environmental change. And this is an example of a pleiotropy. So this is a sickle cell syndrome or sickle cell disease. And what we have is a single mutation in the hemoglobin gene that leads to all of these changes. Typically, when you see a change that has multiple effects, a pleiotropy, what you're seeing is some kind of gene product that is a very basal to the functioning of a lot of different systems. And therefore, the mutation is expressed and has an effect in many different locations. Here you have many different phenotypic consequences. On the other hand, when you have an antagonistic pleiotropy, you're talking about a single gene that is useful in different situations, in different environments, and you can have, therefore, an increase in functioning of the gene in one environment versus a decrease in another environment. And so this is showing antagonistic pleiotropy. Basically, you've got the original allele is right here, the little a allele. You have a mutation that occurs in environment one, that mutation is beneficial, whereas in environment two, that mutation is detrimental. The little a allele has no difference in phenotype, as shown here, between the two different environments, but the big A allele is beneficial in one environment and actually detrimental in another, and that's called antagonistic pleiotropy. So now we turn to mutation rates. So mutations are stochastic processes. That means that they occur by chance. They occur by chance in a number of different ways. They occur by chance in terms of when they occur. They occur by chance in terms of where they occur. They occur by chance in terms of what kind of mutation actually occurs. So the rate of mutations can vary between organisms, vary between as a function of genotypes, vary between species, and also vary within genomes. And those areas of the genomes where mutations are particularly prevalent are called hotspots. Mutations are actively suppressed by various molecular mechanisms. So these are things that are involved in the high fidelity of replication, maintaining that fidelity, and also in terms of the repair of chromosomes. So repair is in terms of DNA damage. If you do not repair DNA damage, you can't replicate your chromosomes, but it is possible, if repair is otherwise impossible, to display something known as error-prone repair, where essentially just random nucleotides are placed in a chromosome instead of the lesions that otherwise are blocking the replication of the cell. And as a consequence of this, what you have are DNA damaging agents that give rise to mutations. When you are suppressing mutations, these suppression mechanisms come at a cost. They come at a cost in terms of the amount of space in the genome is taken up for genes that are responsible for reducing mutation rates. They come at a cost in terms of the production of the products, the typically proteins, enzymes that are responsible for reducing rates of mutation. And they also come at a cost in terms of time. That is in terms of the amount of time that is involved, for example, in replicating a chromosome can be longer when higher fidelity is required. Evolution can only occur as fast as new variation is injected into a population. A new variation comes from mutations, although migration and recombination can play a role as well. The more variation that's found in a population, potentially the faster the population can evolve. Particularly this is in terms of the acquisition of beneficial alleles by a population. The higher mutation rates are, the faster beneficial alleles will be entering into the population, but so too will detrimental alleles. So we've really got three things going on here. We've got mutation rates and the mechanisms needed to sustain the mutation rates at a given rate, with more effort, energy, and time required. The lower the mutation rates that are required. At the same time, you have to have mutations in order to evolve. because you need these beneficial mutations. But the cost of beneficial mutations is that most mutations, in fact, are not beneficial, and a great majority are detrimental. So if you're going to have mutations, a majority of those mutations are going to be detrimental, even though the benefit's only going to come from the beneficial ones. The rate at which mutations accumulate within a population is a function of how many individuals are populated, are mutating rather, and that's the population size. The number of mutations that occur per nucleotide, per round of replication or generation, and also the generation time, because the longer an organism requires to produce the next round of progeny, the longer it's going to be before those new mutations are placed into a population. So even if per generation mutation rates are high, if it takes you, say, 100 years to go through a generation, you're going to be inserting far fewer mutations per unit time, per absolute unit of absolute time, into the population than, say, an organism that replicates every 30 minutes. So antibiotic resistance can be viewed in terms of rates of mutation. So there are two types of antibiotic resistance that is acquired by bacteria. The first is where there's an acquisition of a plasmid, and this would be extra chromosomal resistance. And this isn't acquisition via a mutation, or at least not directly via mutation, but instead as a consequence of migration, genetic migration, and horizontal gene transfer. What I'm referring to here is the second type, which is when you have a mutation. These are typically forms of chromosomal resistance, and what's happening is that there is a modification in the target of an antibiotic within a cell, such that the antibiotic is no longer able to interact with that target in the same way. And so mutations occur randomly. They tend to move into populations, and they tend to be detrimental, so they tend to be lost from populations as a consequence of natural selection. And you can expect the same thing with antibiotic resistance genes. Antibiotic resistance genes also can be viewed as a kind of conditional mutation, where they're advantageous in one environment, but potentially less so in another. And in fact, it can also be seen as an example of potentially of antagonistic pleiotropy, where again, there's an advantage to having the mutation in one environment, but it actually can be detrimental to the organism in another environment. So the obvious environment in which mutation can be advantageous is one that contains the antibiotic to which the mutation confers resistance, and the environment in which the mutation can be a disadvantage can be environments in which the antibiotic is missing. So we can see antibiotic resistance mutations going into the population by mutation, being removed from the population by natural selection, as essentially a selection mutation balance or mutation selection balance. So we've got this population, it's going along, it presumably already has alleles that confer resistance to an antibiotic. You add the antibiotic to the population, and the first thing you see is a decline in the population size. That's a consequence of what can be viewed as hard selection. So the population following the addition of antibiotic is in a decline. And in fact, it will decline to extinction if there isn't sufficient genetic variation within the population to supply a means of countering the impact of this antibiotic. So our antibiotic resistance mutations that are occurring here, or here, or here, they're occurring all over the place. They're not occurring in response to the antibiotic. They're probably not occurring after you've added the antibiotic, because that's a relatively short span of time. But instead, if you have a population, and it's probably prior to the addition of the antibiotic that the mutation arose. Or they just simply can be arising constantly and being lost just as fast as they arise, a steady state. This is the imposition of hard selection by the antibiotic. The population is in decline, but the population displays this genetic variation in terms of antibiotic resistance. And over time, what you see is a rise in the fraction of the population that is antibiotic resistant, until, of course, essentially all the bacteria in the population are antibiotic resistant. You can see that the antibiotic resistance gene confers a disadvantage, a cost to the organism that's displaying it, that's expressing it, because in fact the population size of the resistant organisms, the resistant bacteria, is about 1/10 at peak that of the sensitive bacteria. So that could be due to changes in the environment, but probably is because there is in fact a cost associated with expressing antibiotic resistance. The bacterium has come up with a mutation that blocks the ability of the antibiotic to bind to wherever that mutation in fact is located, blocking the ability of the antibiotic to in fact kill the bacterium, but the result of that is that the bacterium doesn't function as well, and as a consequence, there is a lower peak density of those bacteria. They're less efficient, they're less able to reach higher densities. There is an alternative explanation, however, and that is that it could be that the bacteria are resistant but not completely resistant to the antibiotic. So the antibiotic may still be providing some cost or imposing some cost on the bacterial population, and the result of that cost is that in fact the bacterial population doesn't grow as robustly as it does in the absence of the antibiotic. So the truth is that we actually can't tell here. We can't tell whether this reduction in peak height, peak concentration of the bacteria, is a consequence of the bacteria growing less effectively because of the antibiotic resistant mutation or mutations, or instead because the antibiotic is still imposing a cost on the bacteria that results in less robust growth. So we can talk about mutation rates. Jan Drake is a very important contributor to the study of mutation rates in organisms. This is from an article of his in Holland, 1999. When rates of spontaneous mutation are expressed per genome replication, different broad groups of organisms display characteristic values, which is to say they're similar to one another. Roughly 0.2 mutations per genome replication is seen for retroelements. These are a kind of transposon. On the other hand, you have a rate of mutation of approximately 0.0034 for DNA-based microorganisms, about 10 to the minus 3. That's much higher than the 10 to the minus 6 I just noted. However, we're talking about all of mutations in the organism rather than just specific mutations such as to antibiotic resistance. Roughly 1% of the replication events gives rise to a mutation in higher eukaryotes. So these would be organisms such as ourselves. For RNA viruses, it tends to be much higher. Approximately one mutation per replication event is seen in RNA viruses such as HIV. And these per genome mutation rates, are basically different from per nucleotide mutation rates. If you have a per genome mutation rate that is of some magnitude, say 0.0034, but you're talking about a large genome versus a small genome, in the smaller genomed organism, the per nucleotide mutation rate will be much higher because there's much fewer nucleotides around to mutate. But nevertheless, if you have the same per genome mutation rate, the overall mutation rate across the genome would remain the same. So, for example, compare bacteria with higher eukaryotes. The bacteria have much lower per genome mutation rates, but they also have many fewer nucleotides, and therefore the rate of mutation per nucleotide is actually higher in the bacteria than it is in the higher eukaryotes. But nonetheless, they have fewer nucleotides, so across the whole genome, their mutation rate is lower. What you see here are per nucleotide mutation rates seen with various phages. Now, the per nucleotide mutation rate is going to vary as a function of the size of the genomes of these different organisms and also as a function of the per genome mutation rates. So if you're looking at RNA-based organisms, these would be RNA viruses, Q beta, the phage is an example, they have rather high per nucleotide mutation rates on the order of 10 to the minus 3. Of course, their genomes are not very large. They're only on the order of 10 to the 3, so the rate of mutation that you see is somewhere in the vicinity of 1. Single-stranded DNA viruses can also have relatively high per nucleotide mutation rates, but still this is 100-fold lower mutation rates than you see with this RNA virus. This is also an RNA virus, but it's a double-stranded RNA virus, and in fact it has a per nucleotide mutation rate that is even higher than the single-stranded DNA virus. The size of the genome of this organism is roughly that of this one. Phi-6 is approximately twice that in terms in its size of Phi-X-174. So as a consequence of that, the per genome mutation rate is not tenfold lower for Phi-6 versus Phi-X-174, but perhaps fivefold lower. M13, also single-stranded DNA, it has a lower per nucleotide mutation rate than Phi-X-174, which is another kind of single-stranded DNA phage. Its genome size is roughly the same as Phi-6, a little bit smaller. So the implication is that Phi-6 and M13 are displaying roughly similar per genome mutation rates. However, with the double-stranded DNA viruses, the per nucleotide mutation rates are lower still. So for lambda phage, we're talking about tenfold lower mutation rates, and for T2 and T4, it's another tenfold. So it's 100-fold lower per nucleotide mutation rates for T2 and T4 as double-stranded DNA viruses versus M13 as a single-stranded DNA virus. On the other hand, T2 and T4 have much larger genomes than M13. In fact, T2 and T4 have genomes that are roughly 10 times the size of the genome of M13. So they're not really displaying 100-fold lower per genome mutation rates, but closer to tenfold or even less per genome mutation rates compared to M13. So the genome size is important, and mutation rate per nucleotide per generation is important as well. And also population size is important. And so you combine all those things and you will get an idea of how fast mutations are injected into populations. Keeping in mind that most of those mutations are detrimental, or if not that, neutral. But if you are going to have beneficial mutations within a population, you have to put up with simply mutation loads overall. And the higher the number of mutations per generation, the more beneficial mutations you're going to have injected into the population, but so too the more detrimental and neutral mutations. So there's a type of mutation that gives rise to, in fact, higher levels of mutation. And organisms that display these mutations are known as general mutators or simply mutators. So a mutant that displays significantly higher mutation rates per generation than a parent strain is known as a general mutator. General mutators have defects in the repair of damage to their nucleic acid, and also in terms of their ability to simply replicate their nucleic acid. So one important defect, for example, is the proofreading function of DNA polymerases, or in the proofreading function. General mutators can display really high mutation rates on the order of 100 to 1,000-fold more than the non-mutators. Now, keep in mind that we're talking here the same size genome. So you've got a parent and you've got an offspring that's a general mutator, but they're mostly the same organisms. They have mostly the same size genomes, and yet you're talking 100 to 1,000-fold higher mutation rates in the general mutator. So much more mutations going on a per nucleotide basis with these mutator mutations. General mutators are found among wild bacteria. They are found among pathogenic bacteria. This is in addition to our finding them in certain laboratory strains of bacteria. They tend to evolve in certain experiments that involve serial passage of bacteria, but they don't evolve in all of them. So generally, we can say that general mutators tend to arise, but they don't always tend to arise. And we can ask the question of why is it that they, in fact, arise within populations? Why might they become fixed within populations? What is the advantage of displaying much higher mutation rates? And where is that advantage found? So the advantage is in the greater amounts of useful variation, that is beneficial mutations or beneficial alleles that are injected into populations as a consequence of mutation. And the cost, on the other hand, is that you have greater amounts of deleterious mutations. Under what circumstances might the balance favor the faster rate of injection of variation, even at the cost of higher amounts of deleterious mutations? And the answer to that question probably is, in most cases, that it's when an organism finds itself in an environment that it's not well adapted to, and it really is in need of beneficial mutations. Another way of saying this is that when the rate of evolution is limited by the amount of beneficial mutations that are present within a population, then there are advantages associated with acquiring beneficial mutations at a higher rate. And one way to acquire, in fact, probably the most important way to acquire beneficial mutations at a higher rate is simply to mutate faster. So if we have a repaired proficient genotype, this is a non-mutator strain, you can have a mutation in these repair enzymes and also DNA polymerases, what have you, that gives rise to a mutator genotype, the rate of mutation is much higher. Generally, we don't expect back mutations to occur at the same rate as forward mutations. So once you've generated the mutator genotype, it's difficult for mutations to restore the repair proficient, the non-mutator genotype. Now, if you're a non-mutator genotype, you're going to have some rate of mutation to beneficial mutations and some rate of mutation to deleterious mutations. The rate of mutation to deleterious mutations is always going to be higher than that to beneficial mutations. If the population displays little genetic variation, then if it's in an environment it's not well adapted to, the more beneficial mutations that it acquires, presumably the faster it can evolve and increase its fitness within an environment. And thus, you see the general mutators, where they in fact display overall greater mutation rates, therefore they're injecting far more deleterious mutations into the population than you see with the repair proficient genotype, but they're also injecting far more beneficial mutations. In an infinite population, you're going to have as many beneficial mutations as you possibly could need. But as populations become smaller, the rate at which beneficial mutations arise becomes just as smaller, and therefore there can be benefits associated with displaying simply higher mutation rates so that you in fact have more beneficial mutations being injected into the population. And these mutations, these beneficial mutations, represent the raw material upon which natural selection can act. So all mutations in this case are more likely. Back mutations are still less likely, but actually they're more likely given a general mutator's phenotype than a lack of one, simply because the rate of mutations is higher. So what are the advantages of mutators? So it's essentially more rapid exploration of sequence space. You're generating more variation, and some of that variation may be beneficial. This is important particularly in smaller populations because, remember, population size is an important contributor to how many mutations enter into the population. If you have a smaller population, then you have fewer individuals that are mutating and therefore fewer beneficial mutations. But if you up the mutation rate, then you can have higher, more beneficial mutations. Having a higher mutation rate also increases the likelihood of an individual obtaining multiple simultaneous mutations within a single gene or within a single genome. Sometimes a single mutation may not be sufficient to supply a benefit, but two mutations at the same time may together work to supply a benefit to the organism that that is displaying these mutations. However, in order to have two mutations occur simultaneously within a genome, you have to have high mutation rates. This is particularly helpful in larger populations. Larger populations already have a relatively robust exploration of sequence space simply because you have more individuals mutating. If you can have a reasonably high likelihood of multiple mutations per individual, then you may have a reasonably high likelihood of hitting upon two mutations that together supply an advantage to an individual where separately they don't. And this can simply have the effect of speeding up evolution. Increased rates of exploration of sequence space probably are only transiently advantageous in most circumstances. That is, if you are in an environment in which things have changed and you need to adapt to that environment, at some point you're going to reach a level of adaptation to that environment such that the cost of having these deleterious alleles arising at a higher rate is higher than the benefits that you can obtain from displaying from acquiring beneficial mutations at a higher rate. At that point in time, displaying a general mutator phenotype will no longer be advantageous, and there will be selection for individuals that have happened to mutate back to the non-mutator state. And again, as noted, the rate of mutation of back mutations, although generally is lower than the rate of forward mutation, nevertheless, with a mutator strain, if you're displaying 100 or 1,000 fold increases in rates of mutation, you're still going to have 100 to 1,000 fold increases in the likelihood of a back mutation. So acquiring these back mutations in this case, although is less likely than the forward mutations, there is some reasonable likelihood that they're in fact going to arise in the population simply due to the higher mutation rates overall. Mutator strains also accumulate neutral mutations, and these neutral mutations can contribute to the amount of genetic variation within a population. And upon exposure to new environments, these neutral mutations, in fact, may conditionally take on a beneficial state. Such that, in fact, they're selected for. So it's always good to have a lot of variation within an environment, within a population, so that it can, in fact, respond to environmental change. And a lot of this variation is neutral variation rather than something that has already been selected for. Because if you're trying to respond to a change in the environment, it may very well be that the alleles that were useful in the old environment are not useful in the new ones. That's another way of saying that the alleles that were beneficial in an old environment may not be beneficial in a new environment. Mutator status thus appears to not be advantageous under all conditions. And that presumably explains why it is that, in fact, most organisms are not general mutators, do not display these very high mutation rates. Here we have an experiment in which mutations are accumulating within a population. This accumulation is occurring as a consequence of genetic drift. What we have here is the picking of a single colony and then reestablish of the population from that single colony. So essentially the population is being reduced down to a single cell between each round of propagation. So that's some pretty severe genetic drift to be reducing the population number to one periodically. And it can have the effect of fixing deleterious mutations within the population. And in fact, if the mutation rate of the population, of the individuals in the population, is sufficiently high, you can get the accumulation of a fairly large number of mutations over a relatively short period of time. However, the mutations don't just accumulate and accumulate and accumulate and accumulate until the number of mutations within the population is, in a sense, infinite. And this is because there's always going to be pushback against the accumulation of deleterious mutations, and this pushback is seen is a consequence of natural selection. Now, this is not looking at Mueller's ratchet. This is just looking at the accumulation of mutations within the population. It's not saying anything about the loss of the wild type genotype within the population, which may be occurring as well. It's simply the average number of mutations found within individuals within the population. So here's the original population, and you can see that most of the individuals have zero mutations. This is our starting point. This is wild type. With time, the number of mutations on average per individual increases. So now we have 30% that have a single mutation versus 10%. These are not necessarily deleterious mutations, but if the number, if beneficial mutations are quite rare, and neutral mutations are somewhat less rare than detrimental mutations, as long as the detrimental mutations aren't too detrimental, what we are seeing here is probably the increase in the number of detrimental mutations within the population. And here you can see that what we've got is an average of three mutations, or 30% of the population has three mutations versus 30% having one mutation here. But this isn't following the third round of transfer, but instead an infinite number of transfers. If it was linear, we would expect the number of mutations to just keep increasing, but instead it has stalled. And the reason it stalled is because, again, natural selection is removing deleterious mutations from the population. So you have mutation accumulation, but we also have a balance between mutation and selection, a steady state. At some point, the rate at which mutations enter into the population becomes equal to the rate at which the mutations are removed from the population via natural selection, and you end up with this balance between mutation and selection, a mutation-selection balance that for this population happens to be found at three mutations on average within the population. So we're transferring a single colony. This is our mutation selection balance right here. So it's also possible, if you start especially with organisms that have sufficiently high mutation rates, if you increase mutation rates, or it's possible to, by, for example, adding mutagens to the environment, to lead the organisms to the point where they're accumulating mutations so fast that the population no longer can really survive. So too high rates of mutation leads to an accumulation of detrimental mutations in organisms, and too high will result in all populations accumulating mutations, deleterious mutations, so fast that population growth becomes impossible. So this is known as mutational meltdown, and also known as error catastrophe. There are people who don't like the concept of mutational meltdown or error catastrophe, and I'm not going to argue against them. I'm just going to point out what this phenomena it looks like. So mutational meltdown or error catastrophe is essentially the extinction of a population that's a consequence of that population having mutation rates that are too high. Merely tripling the viral mutation rate, if this increase could be achieved without harming the host, could curb ribovirus infections. So RNA viruses, right from the start, have very high mutation rates. They lack proofreading. They might have mutation rates on the order of one mutation per round of replication. You start increasing that rate of mutation by just a little bit, and the population starts getting into trouble because they're accumulating mutations essentially faster than natural selection can get rid of those mutations while still maintaining a viable population. In other words, the individuals within the population become too quickly burdened with too many deleterious mutations to, in a sense, survive and reproduce. The antiviral ribavirin, which is an anti-hepatitis C drug, may very well work by error catastrophe, so increasing the mutation rate in hepatitis C to the point where, in fact, the population is not able to survive. Now, you could argue that, okay, you're simply damaging the organism enough genetically that by increasing its mutation rate that the organisms basically die. And that's another way of looking at mutational meltdown. Again, not everybody is really happy with the idea of mutational meltdown. So RNA viruses with high mutation rates exist close to mutational meltdown, however you want to think about it, the point at which mutation rates are so high that the population no longer can exist. So mutational meltdown can be induced also in DNA-based organisms. In fact, you can induce mutational meltdown in just about anything. The problem is when you have when you're using a compound as a drug, you also have to be careful that you don't harm the host as well, for example, increasing the mutation rate in a human patient. So there are limitations in terms of drugs in how much mutation, how much you can increase mutation rates in target organisms. But simply in a test tube, those kinds of limitations don't really exist. So this figure is a representation of error catastrophe. It's not really showing you mutation rates so much as the impact of mutations on the fitness of an organism. So infectivity in this case is a measure of fitness, how well these organisms can infect a cell or infect a larger host organism. And when they have zero mutations, they're essentially as fit as they're going to be. When they have one mutation, they perhaps, well, I would say certainly, considering this is two mutations, haven't declined all that much in terms of their fitness. But once you start introducing a little bit more than that, which is difficult to actually see with these points here, but as soon as you're introducing a little bit more than that, apparently there is a catastrophic decline in the fitness of the population. So basically you have okay, and then you just increase the mutation number by a little bit, by increasing the mutation rate, and suddenly the population is no longer able to sustain itself nearly as well as it could in the situation where there was basically a normal amount of mutations or a normal mutation rate in the population. So this drop here is considered to be error catastrophe. With high mutation rates, there's also a concept that's known as quasi-species, and this is also tends to be associated with RNA viruses. And in fact, it's RNA species generally that the idea of quasi-species has arisen in. However, it's more of a theoretical construct as opposed to a biological one. If you've got RNAs that are able to replicate within, say, a test tube, and they're not replicating on their own, you need an RNA polymerase to achieve this replication, but you can have high amounts of mutation and therefore high amounts of divergence in sequence, and this can lead to essentially a cloud of individuals that possess multiple different mutations. In other words, there's a profound exploration of sequence space. And so as a consequence, these RNA species would be seen instead of as simply an individual genotype, but instead a diverse collection of mutationally related individuals, a lot of different genotypes. They're not completely divergent from each other because they started out from the same genotype, but nevertheless, they are quite divergent in terms of their accumulation of mutations. So an approximation of this can be seen in RNA-based living things, such as RNA viruses, with the caveat that whereas quasi-species really doesn't take into account mutation selection balance, when you have an RNA virus, you have to take into account selection, because if you have too many mutations or mutations in the wrong place, you're going to have natural selection against those individuals that simply don't function as well. So this mutation selection balance gives you an equilibrium that really is different from what you see with a quasi-species. But nevertheless, these RNA species do seem to exist as essentially a cloud within sequence space, which you have a basic genotype with lots of variations on it. And to the point where you have just small numbers, small fractions of the population with identical genotypes, but many, many, many different related genotypes, mutationally related genotypes, making up a population. So RNA viruses have huge mutation frequencies. They accumulate a large number of mutations across their populations, and this gives rise to a quasi-species-like population structure. However, selection constrains the population. It eliminates the unfit genotypes, and it otherwise selects for those individuals that replicate faster. So hard selection would be essentially getting rid of those genotypes that are unable to replicate fast enough to keep the population going. And then soft selection would be a description of increased competitive ability between the individual members of the population. So populations of real organisms are constrained in their quasi-species tendencies. That is, constrained in their full exploration of sequence space. And this constraint comes from selection, from natural selection acting on the population. Nothing surprising here. I mean, this is basically what you expect to go on within a population. You have mutation putting variation in. You have natural selection taking variation out. So that's no big deal. RNA viruses basically perform exactly the way you would expect them to, with the caveat that they have very high mutation rates. What I'm saying, though, is that this strictly, this idea of having selection weeding out the population, cutting down on the amount of variation within the population, simply doesn't conform perfectly to the idea of quasi-species. So quasi-species is a great idea. It's a way of thinking about RNA-based populations, but the ideal of a quasi-species can't be met by real populations because you have natural selection. RNA viruses thus form highly organized population composed by a very large number of different but related genomes. So all populations consist of a combination of different mutationally related individuals. RNA species just have a lot more mutationally related types making up the population. So this is a way of looking at RNA species along with adaptive peaks. So with adaptive peaks, you have some variation in phenotype, and you're graphing out on the y-axis here the fitness associated with that phenotype. So low mu here is simply a way of saying that mutation rates, mu, are not high. And when mutation rates are not high, genetic variation isn't being injected into the population essentially faster than natural selection can remove it. And so the population tends to congregate around the high fitness point. So individuals that in fact have mutated away from this essentially wild type genotype or wild type collection of genotypes are eliminated from the population, and therefore the population tends to stay relatively cohesive at the peak of their fitness. Here we have a adaptive peak that is much broader. So there's much more genotype space over which the population in fact can vary without changing its phenotype much. And when you have mutation, the population, if essentially these mutations are neutral mutations, will tend to explore sequence space. However, when you have very high mutation rates, as you see with, for example, RNA viruses, in fact, the mutations are injected into the population in a sense faster than selection can get rid of those mutations. If you have a adaptive peak that has steep sides, it means that a lot of these mutations are detrimental mutations. And that's what's being shown here. And in fact, they will be eliminated from the population. But they're injected so fast at high mutation rates into the population that they simply persist in the population. So this is our cloud. This is our cloud of individuals. We've got, in a sense, a cloud of individuals that is at the peak of fitness. And a larger cloud that surrounds these individuals, in a sense, in genotype space that it consists of a lot of individuals that, in fact, have lower fitness than the peak fitness shown here. Alternatively, if you have a broad adaptive peak, then you can really have this cloud of genotype that is all approximately the same fitness. They're all more or less on top of this adaptive peak. And in fact, a true quasi-species, you wouldn't have a peak at all. You'd have a straight line here. Oops, yeah, mutation rate. You have a straight line here, and essentially the quasi-species would spread along that line, and there'd be no difference in fitness between the individuals. However, in a real population, eventually you're going to have mutations that in fact drive the population down, and more realistically, this population should be throwing off mutants that in fact do display a lower fitness. But nevertheless, what you have is a cloud here of individuals that have approximately equivalent fitness. They're displaying essentially neutral mutations. They're neutral because a mutation that takes you from that genotype there to that genotype there, there's not much of a change in fitness, versus a deleterious mutation, where a mutation that takes you from that genotype to that genotype, you have a rather dramatic drop in fitness. So lastly, we'll talk about migration. So this is, again, we're looking at non-Darwinian evolutionary forces. And so this includes mutation, genetic drift, and migration. So migration is genetic migration. It's the movement of alleles from one population to another population. So recall that migration in an evolutionary biology is movement of alleles into populations, as well as movement out of populations. In organisms that are less sexual, that movement occurs via a variety of horizontal gene transfer mechanisms. In populations that are sexual, this is your standard introgression, where you have hybridization between individuals that are from different populations, essentially from different species, you have the production of progeny that then can backcross to either of the parents, and you end up with movement of alleles from one population to another. Perfectly good species will in fact share alleles with other species at low levels via mechanisms like this. They have to be species that are closely enough related that in fact they can produce viable progeny, because again, these sexual processes are associated with sexual reproduction, therefore vertical inheritance, and this puts severe limitations on how much movement of alleles between populations in fact can occur. You can also have movement of alleles between subpopulations, and that happens fairly readily, except for geographical distances between the two subpopulations, et cetera, et cetera. However, in microorganisms, a large number of them are not obligately sexual. This includes essentially all of the bacteria. And if you're going to have movement, sexual processes, migration, of genetic material alleles between individuals, it's going to happen via horizontal gene transfer. And the interesting thing is that although horizontal gene transfer is much less efficient than sexual reproduction in terms of scrambling together alleles from different individuals, it also is capable of moving alleles from a much broader range of individuals. So as a consequence, genetic migration in microorganisms turns out to be a hugely important aspect of their evolution. And it involves essentially the acquisition of alleles, and not just of alleles, but whole groups of genes, gene complexes, and even groups of genes, so-called islands, such as pathogenicity islands, that can be acquired by, for example, a bacterium in one chunk, and substantially modify the overall phenotype of the bacterium. And these pathogenicity islands, or islands in general, genomic islands, can come from all sorts of different species that are not necessarily the same species as the recipient, nor necessarily even very closely related. So migration turns out to be really important for microorganisms. In bacteria, mechanisms of horizontal gene transfer include transformation, transduction, conjugation. Transformation is the picking up of naked DNA from the environment. Not all bacteria can do that. Transduction is the picking up of DNA that has become associated with the viruses of bacteria, or viruses in general. This can be either generalized transduction, where the entire viral genome has been replaced by, for example, bacterial DNA, or specialized transduction, where only a few genes or a little bit of genetic material has been picked up and has been recombined into the viral genome, so that relatively little genetic materials, in fact, move. But nevertheless, in terms of generalized transduction, huge amounts of genetic material can be moved. We're talking about thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of nucleotides worth. The potential for not just one gene, but multiple genes and multiple pathways can be moved simultaneously. And then conjugation is the uptake of DNA in the form of plasmids. These plasmids, to a degree, are autonomous, parasitic or mutualistic, symbiotic pieces of DNA that either encode their own movement between different bacteria or instead can utilize the mechanisms employed by other plasmids, or indeed can be moved around by phages in the form of transduction. But this is another form by which DNA can be acquired by a cell. Once sexual processes have been initiated, then you need to have additional processes to complete the sexual act, the recombination of this new genetic material into a recipient's genome. One of these mechanisms is homologous recombination. This would be essentially the swapping of genes or the swapping of similar pieces of DNA within the chromosome. You don't get any net gain in the number of loci within a chromosome via homologous recombination. But when you have relatively closely related individuals, you can have fairly efficient integration of new alleles or new forms of alleles into the chromosome of an individual. And a homologous recombination is essentially the same kind of recombination that occurs in the crossing over stage of meiosis that is associated with obligately sexual organisms. Illegitimate recombination is insertion of DNA sequences into the chromosomes of recipient individuals. So this actually does increase the number of loci that are present in those individuals. This is much less likely than homologous recombination in terms of any given piece of DNA. If you've got a piece of DNA sitting in a bacterial chromosome, a bacterial cytoplasm, the likelihood that that DNA will undergo a recombination event will be much higher if there is homology between that DNA and the DNA already found in the chromosome. And if there's homology, then you end up with homologous recombination going on. If there isn't a lot of homology, then you're limited to illegitimate recombination, but this is much less efficient than homologous recombination. And then there also is the acquisition of endosymbionts. I mean, this is a mechanism of migration. It's a mechanism of migration in and of itself. It's the acquisition of all of the genes that are associated with the endosymbiotic organism. So transduction can transfer, 100,000 nucleotides, whereas endosymbiont acquisition might transfer, millions and millions and millions of nucleotides. So it's the potential for acquisition of quite a bit of genetic material. And then that genetic material, once endosymbionts have been acquired, in fact, can be transferred from the endosymbiont to the host chromosome over evolutionary time. So endosymbiont acquisition is for sure another aspect of horizontal gene transfer. This is showing homologous recombination, where you've got a donor organism. It has this allele A associated with it. It's a variation on this allele A, big A here. And so if this allele can find its way into the cytoplasm of the recipient organism, and that can occur as a consequence of transduction or transformation, then you can have homologous recombination and thus the replacement of the big A allele with little A allele. So this is just a gene swap. You haven't increased the number of loci within these individuals. Alternatively, you can have a donor that's some distantly related from, or maybe not, in a sense related at all, from the recipient organism. It too is supplying this allele, I'm calling it alpha instead of little a, that perhaps is similar to this big A allele but doesn't display a whole lot of homology, and as a consequence Homologous recombination is unlikely, but illegitimate recombination can still occur. And when that happens, you actually have an increase in the number of loci found with in the recipient organism. This is an increase in the amount of genetic material carried by the recipient organism. And again, transduction and transformation can supply these other less closely related alleles, and in a sense, so can conjugation. I mean, alleles can be brought in on plasmids as well. As the size of the genome increases, to some degree, there's going to be limits on how big the genome can get without impacting substantially the organism's fitness, the recipient organism's fitness. And just as there are mechanisms such as this illegitimate recombination that can increase the size of a genome, so too there are mechanisms, particularly deletion of genetic material, of DNA, that can decrease its size. And so you end up with what presumably is a balance between acquisition and loss of DNA within, for example, bacteria. And as a consequence, the size of bacterial genomes stays more or less constant over time. Not hugely constant, but it doesn't change by orders of magnitude. So this is a summation of various ways in which evolution occurs. In a clonal population, mutations inject the genetic variation, and then these organisms are subject to natural selection. In a sexual population, mutation again injects the genetic variation into the population, but you can have mutations occurring in different individuals and end up with those mutations in the same individual as a consequence of sexual processes. And then those individuals are subject to natural selection. You can have more distant movement of genetic material that does not involve a sexual reproductive act via horizontal gene transfer. In this case, again, the mutations can occur in separate individuals and then find their way into the same recipient individual. In fact, they can occur in separate lineages and separate species and find their way into a single recipient individual and then are subject to natural selection. As we noted, transformation, transduction, and conjugation are the major ways in which horizontal gene transfer occurs between bacteria. And you see also, especially transduction in eukaryotic cells. You also have evolution by endosymbiont acquisition. And in this case, again, mutations can occur in separate organisms. And the organisms can come together in an endosymbiotic event. You essentially have a fusion of two species to form a new organism. And then that new organism, which essentially is the product of migration, the movement of alleles from one population to another, from the endosymbiont to be to the recipient host, and then ultimately to whatever the combination of endosymbiont and host the resulting organism represents. And then those two are subject to natural selection. So mutation is important. Genetic drift is important, and also migration is important. And in fact, migration is hugely important so far as microorganism evolution is concerned. But so too is natural selection, and that's the next chapter that we'll be covering, is on natural selection. interaction is a means by which information can flow from That was unpleasant. We'll see if I leave that in the, if you didn't see that, a fruit fly or something to that effect just kind of flew into my mouth. And I believe I've swallowed it. And we'll see if I leave that in the video. At any rate, getting back to this. So natural